हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 10. According to the Vaishnava scholars, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is both Saguna and Nirguna. Whenever Shastra describes the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Nirguna, near without guna qualities, the meaning is that the Lord is not tinged with material contamination. And Saguna, applied to Krishna, indicates that the Lord is full with perfect transcendental qualities. Quote, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, the Lord descends on earth by his own internal potency, and therefore there is no question of his becoming materially contaminated, changed, or otherwise affected by the modes of material nature. The Lord is Saguna by his own internal potency, but at the same time he is Nirguna, since he is not in touch with the material energy. The restrictions of the prison house are applicable to prisoners who are condemned by the king's law. But the king is never affected by such implications, although he may visit the prison house out of his good will. Srimad Bhagavatam 3.7.2 purport. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur summarizes the discussion about Saguna and Nirguna, Brahman, in his book Amnaya Sutra, where Savishesha and Nirvishesha stand for Saguna and Nirguna. Because Vishesha means special, or not special. You know, with specialness, without specialness, like that. Also notice here is that these points that Prabhupada's making, there's no question of his becoming materially contaminated, changed, or otherwise affected by the modes of material nature. So those aren't arbitrary just ideas. Those are the things that people will attribute to Krishna when he comes to this world, right? The impersonalists and other persons. You know, that he becomes contaminated because he comes under the influence, like Shiva's under the influence of the mode of ignorance, like that, changed, that he is, you know, transforms into something else, you know, just like us, our consciousness is supposed to, he's covered by the illusion, so therefore that's created the material existence, so this is not happening with him. And otherwise affected, that he's not like in charge of the mode of goodness and that, like you see the Satyanarayan Puja, so they worship Vishnu and all that, but it's part of Panchopasana, where they're worshiping him as the Lord of the mode of goodness, but that he's in the mode of goodness. So they're worshiping Vishnu in the mode of goodness. They're not actually worshiping Vishnu that we worship, who is transcendental. This is someone of this world, but the best of those of this world, right? So these are all different kinds of concept, misunderstandings of Krishna's position. So that's why Prabhupada mentions them. So now Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Amnaya Sutra. Sutta 4, Nityam Savishesham. He has a variety of transcendental qualities eternally. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. In the Shweta Sutara Upanishad 6.6 it is said, quote, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not touched by the material nature, and he is free from the entanglement of the complex tree of material time. He is the origin of the material creation, and it is due to him only that everything changes. He is the protector of religion and the annihilator of all sinful activities. He is the master of all opulences, and everything rests within him. He is the supersoul present in everyone's heart. Those who understand and worship him become free from the cycle of birth and death. in the material world and return to the eternal spiritual world. Quote, the word Bhagavan means that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has all knowledge, strength, wealth, fame, beauty, and renunciation, and no faults. Srila Rupa Goswami Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 2.137 explains, quote, these five qualities that jivas cannot possess, but the demigods like Shiva can, as well as all Vishnu tattvas, are 1. Always being situated in one's original position, 2. Being omniscient, 3. Being always fresh and youthful, 4. Being the concentrated form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss, and 5. Possessing all mystic perfection. Okay, so this is Savishesha. He's always with qualities, right? So that is always presented first. We generally take to go from the negative then into the positive. But the positive, once it's presented, that's what you understand. Then the negative then be seen in light of that, right? Once you've established the actual position, then any contrary positions then can be explained in connection with that. So the Vedic system will generally work like that. It means what it is that you want the person to understand, what you want him to think, what you want him to behave, that's given first. Then after that, things that go against that won't be favorable to that, right? Because otherwise, why should you do an activity if you don't know what its benefit is, right? So that being the benefit, then it's good. Sir, that's kind of like the ladies' area. Maybe you could shift to this side. Just this side of the column there. Yeah, that's good. Okay, so now he's established he has these five qualities. Then as Bhagavan, he has these six attributes. And then how everything's coming from him, everything's established in him, and everything becomes nice and all that. Or rather, anywhere else, if that's too smoky, then. So, these different positions then bring out, does that make sense? So, in other words, we know what's correct first. Then we find out what happens if you don't follow those. Or you do things that are against that. Then what is the reaction? Does that make sense? Just like in Vedic education, you first learn what it is the proper standard. Then after that, then you learn any exceptions or anything that is improper. Does that make sense? So you would learn, like first you would learn what is actual history, what's real history, about persons who are worth learning about, that they have qualities that are worth emulating, you know, worth following and all that. Then after that, if there's an importance, then you hear histories of those who are not so useful. Right? Then you understand the connection. Right? Does that make sense? If let's say we studied Western medicine, let's say we're taking medicine. Then if we studied Western medicine, how its concepts and everything, its development from, you know, we go back probably to the Greeks or something. They won't go before the Greeks, right? So then they'll bring it up through into that, up to modern, and it'll look pretty good. Then we'll look over at Ayurveda, and then it's a different system that's very different, right? So then you'll have a tendency to put them both on the same level, or the Western is, you know, quite okay, and then the Ayurveda is, you know, an alternative kind of thing that's also good, and since we're, you know, follow the Vedic culture, therefore that's more our leaning, but, you know, both, it's just a different way of doing something, right? So we'll apply more the liberal element to it, that, you know, it's just different. It's not that it's right or wrong, they're just different. If you study the Ayurveda first, you understand actually how medicine works, the concept of it, the science of what is health. Then if you study Western medicine, it takes a whole different concept, because they don't even understand that health is based on the balance of the mucous bilinear. And so there's various ways that that can be thrown off. You know, by contamination, you catch some disease from some impure place, anxiety that's there, or improper diet and lifestyle, that these can all generate it. Something so simple. They can't tell you that. They can't tell you what the liver does. They don't even have a system to correct the liver. Right? They don't have it's the most important organ in the body for the running, not to keep you alive. That you need your heart and lungs. But as far as the whole system functioning, it does practically most everything, but they don't know anything about it. So then it would put it in a different light, that the Ayurveda, you know, then has the complete knowledge, and then the other is not so developed. You know, they've developed some aspects very nice, especially their surgery. They're very expert at that. You know, they do quite well in that. And some of their chemical medicines, which fall in the range of what the Ayurveda would call poisons, right? You have herbs, you have, minerals, and then you have poisons, right? So all three are different kinds of medicine. So they'll generally always lean on poisons. It's very rare they'll use something that's not poison. It means you go pre-World War II, then they'd use a lot more, your chemical sulfur and all these other things. They would use much more, your minerals and metals and those kind of things. And some herbs, but not so much. You'd have to go much further back to find the herbs to be prominent. Right? So then you'd notice that there's a certain trend to the medicine, right? It's developing, but also its concept of it is degrading. Right? Instead of using the more natural things in an unsophisticated way, they developed and learned how to use poisons in a very sophisticated way. And how to deal with diseases without surgery, that is not so developed, and how to deal with that they develop. So you see is that they've taken certain parts of the Ayurveda and taken those to a very high level. But it's not complete. Does that make sense? Because what's going to happen is you're going to look at the West, and that then when you learn the new subject, you're going to compare it to that. Does that make sense? So since you didn't learn the science of medicine by studying Western medicine, or the history of it, then you're not going to be so noticing that when you study the Ayurveda. Well, if you study Ayurveda first, you'll understand the science of medicine. Then when you look at the Western, you can actually see what is actually strong in it and what's weak in it. Does that make sense? So in the same way is that we look at the element that Krishna has qualities, right, and all that, then we can understand what no qualities means, because we've accepted the principle of qualities. But then we understand no qualities means no material qualities, because those are inferior. Why you would need inferior qualities when you can have superior qualities? Right? But if we look at it from Nirvisesh first, then we look at it no qualities and what that means, then when we look at qualities, the tendency is to kind of tone them down. That's not the prominent element. Okay, Krishna's God. That's why he's special. But actually, Krishna's special because of his qualities. Everyone in Vrindavan likes him because of his qualities, not because he's God. Like that. Does that make sense? So the focus changes, you see? So it's actually a methodology of teaching. Like that. What do you call that? The educational science? Didactics?
Pedagogy.
Huh?
Pedagogy.
Pedagogy. You know, these things, in other words, it's actually the science of training. Is you learn what reality is first, then you compare non-reality to that. Right? If you know what a theist is, you can understand what's an atheist. Right? Because an atheist doesn't stand on his own. An atheist doesn't believe, but then that means you have to already understand God that he doesn't believe in. But from their own position, how do you explain God? So you can't understand what an atheist is by studying atheism first and then theism. That makes sense, right? If you know what is good cooking, then you can understand what's bad cooking. But if you study bad cooking first, how are you going to really appreciate good cooking, right? So it's just the methodology, and so that's the way that one deals. Okay, so it's a method of teaching. Yes.
So if Ayurveda is not really having an impact on an individual, is it to be understood that maybe that person's body is so much in the mode of ignorance that the poison will actually give the desired result, but something more subtle won't?
Yeah, I mean, there would be the aspect, it just means one would use more powerful medicines, even in Ayurveda. See, you have the science and you have the art. right? So science, basically everybody knows. There'll be very few disagreements on the science like that. Some attribute the qualities of kapha to vata and some to that. They reverse those on which mode they are. But other than that, basically there's the same understanding. The difficulty comes is in the art of application. They're not very clever. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, let us say, in music, everybody's heard of a tabla, right? But very few have heard of pakawaj like that, or heard it played. Even though the pakawaj is the actual Vedic instrument. And the tabla is you take the pakawaj and chop it in two. You know, and so you have two separate things. Is that originally people's voice, they were very powerful people. Their sadhana and everything, and their health and diet, so that when they would sing, then they required very rich instruments to play with them. So you needed the pakawaj, which is very powerful and very full and sound. But as they got into more light things, as the Mughal influence came in, then it was more in the kind of the delicateness of the music rather than the fullness of it. So then the pakawaj is too powerful. So then they developed the tabla, which is done with, you know, like very thin goat skin and everything like that. That you just touch it, you can make sounds. You don't actually have to hit it. So it becomes very, you know, useful in that way. But you can get all the same sounds in the pakawaj, but it's just, it's just more full. It's more loud. So now somehow or another, because of the influence of just the direction of the flavor of music of people's interest, then in at least in North India, all your good percussionists, they play tabla. And the ones that are more traditional, but that's all it is they're traditional, but they're not necessarily inspired. They're just pious people. They play the pakawaj. So then what happens is when you listen to the pakawaj now, it doesn't sound very good. You know, it's very simple and ordinary. You know, well, if you listen to tabla, you have all the people that are inspired. So they both know the same science, but the difference is in the art of application. So therefore, one will tend to towards the tabla. Yes.
And the same thing happens with Ayurveda.
I've
been around for 25 years trying to find Ayurvedic Kaviraj who actually know something and know how to apply it, and it's almost impossible.
It's very rare.
Or finding medicines who are actually potent.
Yeah.
Whereas homeopathy and also allopathy is much more...
Because you have people that are inspired by it or focused.
Yes.
But it's not that it's not there, but it's not... Difficulties are most likely, I mean, that's a side thing, that you're most likely not going to find it all in one place. There's also things that they don't know. Like, people that know the science will tell you this. Local herbs grown in the local place, taken by a local person, then you take one dose as the Ayurveda describes it. Right? Someone who's not from the locale, but is, you know, but is in the locale, then you would give them 1.5 times the dose. And it says if they're from like Sindh or Punjab, you would give them double the dose. Because from over there, the Sindhis, they're, you know, famous for their drinking and meat eating and rough lifestyle. So anybody who's either is living a lifestyle like that or has lived a lifestyle like that, they actually have to take double the dose to work. So much of the medicine you're taking would work if you took a double dose, at least 1.5 times. But a single dose won't do it. But most doctors don't know this. So they themselves get frustrated and wonder why it doesn't work. But this was told to us by one South Indian Kaviraj, that this is generally an unknown thing. Also, you have the element is that in a particular area, you can only make so much medicine at one time, one batch. It can only be so big. That's the rule. And it'll have the full potency. If you make double of that, you can do it. It'll become the medicine, but it'll only have half the potency. So when you have some of these companies that churn out, you know, millions of, you know, bottles of this particular medicines and ship it all over the world, then the potency drops. So it's just you have to take a lot more of it. You know. But so these things aren't known or understood. also that the medicine is offered to the deity, and then then you chant, you know, your mantra over it, you know, which was your initiation. So for us, we'd use Gopal mantra. Then when you give it to somebody, you say the mantra. When they accept it, they say the mantra. When they take it, they say the mantra. If all that's in place, then generally, just by putting the medicine on the tongue, it should work. That's proper Ayurvedic medicine. When it hits the tongue, it works. You know, so if it takes longer, then that means all these things aren't in place. So most people don't know this, though the Ayurveda says it right there. But people just leave that. Because it's important. Like, and one Chinese doctor was telling me that main difference between the Ayurveda and the modern Chinese medicine is that the modern Chinese medicine was Ayurveda before. It was exactly the same. But then 2,500 years ago, they stopped using the mantras. You know, so then after that, that's then when it started. It means that it works on the same principles, that it just started developing in its own way, you know, using local herbs and that. But the science was exactly the same. So, you know, these things happen. So it's a matter of finding those who know something, and then you can catch these things. You know, some people make very good medicine. They commit themselves to that, but may or may not be great doctors. Others are good doctors. I've seen many good doctors. They don't make medicine, so they have to depend upon the locally manufactured medicine. So if you can figure out that combination, then you'll probably find something. A little more work, but is that okay? Okay. So that's the saguna, okay? Sa-visesham. Now, Sutra 5. Nityam nirvisesham cha. He also has no qualities eternally, right? Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura. In the Katha Upanishad 1.3.15, it is said, by understanding the Supreme, who has no sound, no touch, no form, no death, no taste, no scent, no beginning, and no end, and who is eternal and greater than the greatest, one is rescued from the jaws of death. In the Harivamsa it is said, quote, O Bharata, what you see is effulgent Supreme Brahman. I am that eternal Brahman. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 6.1.41, explains, quote, wherever there is an impersonal description in the Vedas mean to establish that everything belonging to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is transcendental and free of mundane characteristics. So, yeah. So that brings it in line with what is there before. You understand? You can see that going in this way, that the description, the negative description, is in relationship to the positive. Right, so its actual position becomes understood. Well, if you do it the other way around, it becomes relativized. Right, it's just a method. Does that make sense? So these orders are important. They mean things. You know, I mean, a simple thing like for us, you have that quote Prabhupada uses. You know, books are the basis. Preaching is the essence. Utility is the principle, purity is the force. You keep it in that order, it means one thing. You change the order, you actually change the purport. Right? Because books are the basis means everything that whatever's done is considered in relation to the books. If it's not supported by books, it's just not done. So from the books, then they're saying the essence is preaching. Right? You're going to learn this knowledge, you're going to practice it, but the important point is you're going to give that to others. And what you're giving is based on the books. Utility is the principle. That will also be based on the books, that everything will be connected back to Krishna. And purity is the force, right? That will be, in relationship, means if you're going to connect things to Krishna, it still has to be based on the purity. And based on the Shastra. Then everything will work. But if you change the order, you say preaching is the essence, so then the point is that that's actually the point, just get it out. Then whatever may be next, then that will then be, how you say, the determining factor of that. You understand? Because most devotees, when I see, they quote it, many times they quote it, you know, and the way Prabhupada said, many times they change it. But they don't understand by changing it, you actually change the meaning of the verse. So there's an importance, right? You know, you have head, arms, you know, stomach and legs. So that order works. So you can put it together in another order, but you'd end up with a different being, even though all the parts are there. Right? Does that make sense? You know, like trees, they eat through their feet. You know? So it's a different entity. So that's why then it must be studied in that way. Otherwise, much of the time we study the modern, and then we look into the Vedic. No, you should study the Vedic, then look into the modern. Then you'll actually be able to make the proper comparison and see the connections. Yes?
Is that why it takes more work to unlearn something?
Yes, it takes more work to unlearn them. That's why he probably gives that famous example of someone who's already studied music. When they go to this big music school, they would have to pay more because it would take longer to unlearn them from the other concepts and then retrain them in that. Like that. It's just like you'd say, let's say, like the Vedic math. You explain it to an adult, much of the time it takes them a little more time to catch it because they already have a concept of numbers, how they'll work. You know, they'll get it because they're smart, but it's just, it won't immediately make sense. But like for the kids, they don't have another concept of math. You show them the Vedic math, and that makes perfect sense. Like that. You know, same with English grammar. You know, this Sanskritized English grammar, you tell to the kids it makes sense because it's just logical. I remember once I was explaining it, and in the audience was a PhD, you know, who's quite good in, you know, in literature and all that. I had to separately explain it to them for 10 minutes because they couldn't catch the concept because they were so conditioned to how they normally would view the English language. But they were viewing the art of the usage of English language. They weren't actually, they had never learned actually the science of language. Right? Because you can't get that by studying English. You know what I'm saying? Because it's a communication. It's an art. Right? It's not a science. Like that. Does that make sense? Latin's more of a science, but English is an art. Does that make sense? So this whole point of science first, then art. That's the Vedic principle. You always have to learn the science of it first, then the art of it. If you learn the art first, then there'll always be a problem because the art is what the mind is dealing with. So the Vedic concept is the intelligence should be the senior and the mind should be the junior. Right? Because that means the mind will always follow the intelligence. But at the same time, it's because the intelligence is the senior, then its business is to take care of the needs of the junior. Right? But it will be done from the standards of the senior. Does that make sense? That then you have proper relationship in all aspects of the society and in the workings in your own mind and everything and in the standards of how the philosophy and everything else works. Right? Well, if you put the art first, then the mind becomes the senior and then the intelligence becomes the junior. So then the intelligence's only business is to figure out what the mind wants according to the mind standards. So that means many options that are actually there would be neglected because the mind doesn't look at them. Well, intelligence will look at all the options and what's actually the best for the time, place, and circumstance. Right? But the other one is you're actually leaving out so many options because the mind isn't interested. Does that make sense? So actually, even though it seems it would be more artistic approach, it's actually your options are limited more. You may be more very inspirational in a very limited area. But the idea is everyone learns the science, there's a common basis, because art isn't necessarily the common aspect, because each person has a way they deal with it. Right? It means it's like some sections of society, if you speak fancy words, they get insulted. Right? They get insulted because it's like, you know, you're speaking over my head. You think I'm an idiot or something. That's why you're doing it. Rather than just you were using some nice words. Right? So that doesn't, but if the science is the common point, then according to each individual's ability, then they can, with their inspiration, that develop it and present it very nicely. Right? You know, if everybody knows the same science of cooking, everybody can cook. Now within that you have individuals who are more inspired and they can do more amazing things and put it together and think of things that no one else would think of. Right? That makes them special. But everybody can cook. Well, nowadays, because it's an art, therefore some people know the art and others don't know it all. So where's the common platform? Where's the common culture? There isn't. You know what I'm saying? Not that, European cooking or Indian cooking. No, we're just talking cooking. You know, there's no common understanding of the science of cooking. So how do you base that? Then if that's there, that means there's no common value of food and eating and serving and, you know, association. You know, bunkte bujayate. It's 33% of Vaishnav interaction. And it's not necessarily valued by very many people. So that means one-third is gone. Right? And nowadays, of course, confidentially, the name of truth is gone. So that leaves you with gifts. And because life is tough, how many people give in charity? So then what's left for Vaishnav interaction? Not a whole lot. Vunches, Prabhu, vunches. You know, that's about it. So that's why it's important. The science is always first, then the art. The art is very important. The Vedic culture is very developed, very refined, so the art is very important. But unless it's based on the science, how great will you be? It's like if you have great inspirational ability, then the more you understand the science, the greater will be your ability to present it. Right? You know a little of the science, you'll do nice. You know more of the science, you can do so much more. Like that. You know, it's like you see these, there's some elements of, like in the South Indian, where they play these Nadeshwars, these big long, they're like Shanais, but they're really big. And they have these things where they're waiting for a festival or that, and so they have to fill the time. The deity will come out after like 3 hours. The people already start to congregate way before. So sometimes for hours, they're just sitting there. There'll be one drum and one of these guys. And all they do is improvise for the whole time. They're not playing things that they learned from a book. They're just improvising. And the stuff they do, how they improvise and all that, much of that then you would see like in your modern jazz. But you don't hear of jazz guys sitting around and think for that long a time with no attitude, just being able to, and no audience, just being able to play like that. Just on and on and on. They could do it for days. So that's because they both have inspiration, but one knows the science more and one just has the inspiration. So they're having to work with their limited, tools with inspiration. They do some nice things. But if they know the science, then if you know the science, even someone who's not inspired at least is good and efficient. They can do it. It's nothing special, but it's standard. You would consider it, good quality. It was a nice lunch. It was a standard sabji, standard, rice sabji like that. It was well cooked, properly done. Nothing really special, but it was, proper and good taste and everything like that, like that. Does that make sense? So there's a basis. So that's the whole idea, is why all we're saying this is because that's the Vedic system of education. Is this always the science first? And then once that's there, then according to the individual, because that's not individual, that everybody learns. It means if individual is what science you learn, right? That will be your generic individual. But then specific individual will be within the science how much of the art you're able to learn. Does that make sense? Kshatriyas learn, statesmanship, like that. Vaishyas learn their economics. But then within that, what variety and what elements that will be then. How much of the art you can teach to them. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's important. So we see that here in the presentation. Like we've seen, Bhaktivinoda Thakur consistently used that. He's presented the nature of the soul, so the science of it. Then the application in the pure soul. then the application of the conditioned soul. Right? And here we're talking about sagun, nirgun. It's always sagun is first, then nirgun. Okay? Yes?
Is there a place for experiencing something so bad first and then going to the position where it's so good?
Experiencing the bad first and then going to the position of good. Narad Muni means it is a system that can be used. And it can be quite efficient, but it's not necessarily the most recommended. Like you see in the seventh canto, Narad Muni then describes the four varnas and ashrams. Then at the end of that, it's ashram dharma. He's doing ashram dharma first. Then at the end of that, then he describes the method of the mlechas. Is that they absorb themselves so much in sense gratification that they actually burn out. Then at that moment, if they're fortunate and get good association, they could take up the process. Right? But if they don't, then they generally become, you know, impersonalists or voidists or something like that. So it can work to take it up, but the only problem is then when the anxiety that drove them to take up the process is relieved, then their determination to follow the process may not be as dynamic. Does that make sense? So it'll always have to be there in anxiety to keep them moving. You know? And therefore we see the disaster element is much more a common theme in the Western lifestyle, because otherwise it won't make them move forward. Right? Because the pious lifestyle isn't actually necessarily, at least in the modern times, the basis. You know, it's the impious lifestyle. Means Western culture basically wouldn't function if everybody followed the four regulative principles, right? Where it means governments wouldn't be able to function without the revenue coming in from intoxication and gambling and all those things. They wouldn't be able to function. So then you know, how would they? It just wouldn't work. The culture. The difficulty is it can go. It can. So that would be one difficulty. More of that's laziness would come in. But at the same time, if they just keep going out of habit, then, you know, it'll go nice. It'll be pleasantly, you know, kind of going kind of sideways in Krishna consciousness. They'll have to be all going up a little bit, otherwise they're going down a little bit in something. You can't just, there's no such thing as, you know, a flat line is called dead, right? You know, that's the common understanding. It's got to be going up or down, right? You know. So then got into flat line and, you know, and whose position on this and stuff.
This one's inspired by anxiety.
Yes. So the other thing is then there's also the which is more deep, is the element that there isn't faith that something can work. You know what I'm saying? That's also not an uncommon thing, is that due to adversity and the consistency of adversity in their life, due to not knowing the proper science of human life, then there's also the idea that actual human life doesn't exist and can't exist. That would be your subconscious opposition to the Vedic culture. They don't actually believe that it will give you security and will give you, you'll be happy. Right? So that's the difficulty, because the nirgun is the prominent in their life. Sagun doesn't mean anything to them, because they don't believe it exists, like the impersonalist. The impersonalist says, there is no sagun. So we say, there is no Vedic culture. It won't work. It won't actually provide what we're looking for. We have to be practical, right? We're Westerners, so we have to be practical. And therefore, we have to take up these things. But the point is we're saying that God's laws won't work on us, because we don't actually believe in them. We only believe in what we believe in, because science hasn't been learned. So it's only what the mind has gained from experience. And in our experience, we haven't seen any. We haven't seen real relationships, real friends, real love, real care, people going out of the way for us. Everybody does whatever's good for them. So this idea of sacrifice and that, and that God would actually do this, so we just look at it, why am I having so much problem? Rather than, the material world's here because we wanted it, God doesn't want it. You know, he sits in everybody's heart. He arranges as much as according to your good work or bad work for you to get what you want. Right? And what you want may have absolutely nothing to do with him. Right? It's totally without him. It's totally atheistic. But he's arranging it for you. Right? So now, what about that? What qualities does it take in a person to be able to do that for someone else? Especially when they're so great and unlimited and you're so small. You know, it's another thing you do that for someone else because, you know, they're great, you'll get something from them. But here it's like, you know, you have unlimited compared to 10,000 the tip of a hair. It doesn't quite add up, you know. So you'd have to have great, unlimited, good qualities to do that for someone else. But that doesn't come into our calculation. It's just, why did Krishna allow this to happen or that to happen? Does that make sense? So that's the weakness of going in from that angle. But the point is Krishna's system is so perfect and complete, it'll still work. You know what I'm saying? It'll still work. So that's why there's no need to, anyone should feel bad, because it doesn't matter where you start from once you just know the weaknesses of it and strengths of it. Right? So it'll make, one is without, you know, with a practical understanding, you know the material world is bad. Right? So therefore, you try to find something on the transcendental platform. Right? To replace it. The difficulty is because one doesn't necessarily understand transcendental culture, you know, or even culture at all, right? Unless it's yogurt, of course. But other than that, then you don't know how to move forward. So even you've taken up the spiritual, you've thrown out all the negative material, you have nothing to replace it with. Right? The karmi food is bad, I throw that out. But I don't know how to cook, so I can't cook Indian. And so it doesn't come out very nice. And so therefore, then I'd rather cook, you know, what few limited little Western cooking I know. You know what I'm saying? It'll go back to that. I don't know how to get together and serve prasad and do a whole thing around that. So therefore, we'll hold a lawn party. You know, everybody cooks enough for 5 people, right? You know, and brings it all and everyone sits around and, you know what I'm saying? So we don't know, but the need is there for social interaction, that we're human beings. The need is there for religiosity, but we don't know what it is. That's the weakness. So if one understands that, then one knows, okay, I have to learn the science of human life. Right? I didn't know that before. Whatever little bits of, and in learning that, then I'll see what things that I knew before were connected and are useful. Right? Because there were some things. Just that you meet somebody and you greet them, you know, that's part of the Vedic culture. So that part I keep. You know, not that now it's spiritual, you know, I just, you know, look the other way. You know, there's interaction. You know, that you interact with people, you give them gifts, you feed them, you interact, you do something with them, activities. Those aspects are good, but just how you do that, whether you knew the science or you just did it because others did it, you know, and then what's the art of it? Then it becomes strong, as long as you understand. In other words, through knowledge, you can start from anywhere. You've come from a pious background, you come from an impious background. Through knowledge, you make it work. Otherwise, then there's the thing, because of pious background, then you'd be conditioned by the mode of goodness. You won't be so dynamic in trying to progress forward in the spiritual, because you don't have, the material world isn't a botheration to you. Right? Because you're pious, everything goes nice. So then that's also a problem. And then it can't just only go nice for the person coming from the sinful background, because his impetus in taking up Krishna consciousness is to remove the pain. So if the pain's gone, his impetus to move forward will also go, just like the pious person. But the pious person will continue in his pious habits, while the impious person now removing all obstacles may go back to the impious habits because they don't know pious habits. Understand? So that's why a little anxiety makes both systems work. But the technical thing that's the real thing is knowledge. Because if you don't have knowledge, even the anxiety will not be a good enough impetus. You know, many people become atheists. Like that. Does that make sense? So the important thing is intelligence. So that's why Krishna is recommending a Gita, Buddhi Yoga, the yoga of intelligence. With that, wherever you start from, it doesn't matter. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has made that point. Wherever you start from, that doesn't matter. It's using your intelligence to know where I am and to identify it and take that to the actual position. But that means I have to know the picture. I know the complete picture, then I know where I am in that picture. And I know where Krishna is, so I just draw a straight line between the two. Right? Then it works very nicely. Does that make sense? So it's not that one is... means, of course, the pious is always better than the impious. But as far as going back to Godhead, it doesn't matter where you start from. Because the potency is in your commitment to the process. So you can be very pious, move very slowly. You can be from an impious background, move very quickly because of your commitment. Of course, if you are very pious and very committed, those are called acharyas, right? You know, so... it's also good. It's not bad. Is that okay?
Yeah. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Oh, just one note on the Ayurveda thing, on the inspiration. Prabhupada, in those last days, and he was very ill, then he talked about this medicine called Mukhardwaj. So Mukhardwaj is in the Ayurveda is classified and categorized as a poison. Right? As a medicine, it's a poison. It's actually a very powerful poison. But if it's used on the right disease, you know, at the right time, it will correct the disease. Right? You know, it's like fire against fire, you know, but if it's used at the wrong time, you get more fire, right? So then Prabhupada wanted this Mukhardwaj, and then he told the devotees where there is a Ayurvedic doctor who has made this medicine, you know, and would know about it, so you bring him. So they convinced that Ayurvedic doctor to go from Calcutta to Vrindavan because they came in and said, you know, our Guru Maharaj had a dream that you had made this medicine. And he says, nobody knows I made this medicine. Right? So he agreed to go. So then when he met Prabhupada, saw his symptoms and all that, and then he told Prabhupada that only someone who was exceedingly well-versed in Ayurveda would be able to understand that those symptoms in Mukhardwaj would be connected. He said only the top-most Ayurvedic doctors could understand this. Your common Ayurvedic doctor would never understand this. So that's the element of inspiration, is that you can connect together things on how the mucus bilin air works. And so then you could do that. But the problem was this, the doctor was worried that it was that Prabhupada's symptoms were too severe and that the Mukhardwaj wouldn't act as medicine, would act as poison. So then Prabhupada took that he wanted to try anyway, you know, because there's no loss. If it's that far gone, it doesn't matter. So he took it, and then the next day you could see it was creating a blue hue. So then for Prabhupada was looking at his arm, he could see the blue and said poison, you know, like that, meaning that the Mukhardwaj acted as poison. So then they stopped taking it, and then the doctor went out and he went around Vrindavan and collected, I forget how many it was, like 16 or some, all kinds of amazing herbs, and then they were ground into powder and everything like that. But, so unfortunately that also is the source of the poison conspiracy, because probably used the poison. He's in relationship to Mukhardwaj, not something else, right? Whatever. But unfortunately it doesn't make such good copy, right? But that's an example of someone who knows the science so well and is so expert at the art of it that they can connect things that most the normal person would never connect together. They would never understand. You know, it's just like, let's say you're going around the corner. The fastest way to go around the corner in let's say a car is to turn in the opposite direction that you want to go. But only people very expert at that can do that. Does that make sense? So it doesn't make sense. No one else would take it that way. Because you go a little bit, you go around the corner, and you want to go left, you turn left. But the point is if you go really fast left, the car will slide. So when it's sliding, you turn right. Because if you turn left, you'll spin. But only people very expert would know that or could do that. So that's art, you know, but based on the science. Does that make sense? So your common person would never understand that. So that's the thing, is you're dealing with common people are taking up Ayurveda. All the guys that have the brains that could do special things in Ayurveda are going into Western medicine. That's the problem. Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. You might get more out of a guy like Svoboda. Svoboda? He's a Westerner.
Where is he at?
He writes books. Problem is he's an agora, so his philosophy is totally off the wall. But his medicine's good.
Okay. No, I'm not too much into it. It's just that I've tried so many guys and I went to so many guys. And
whatever they give you, take gently 1.5 times the dose. I always found that that's what works for me.
Well, I was disappointed by the guys and I was disappointed by the medicine. So then it's just...
No, that's fair. That's of course.
Somehow.
But if you know it's a good medicine, you know it connects despite the guy, then just take a greater dose.
Yeah.
You know, if they say take, you know, like you buy these pills or something, they take 2 pills twice a day, take 2 pills 3 times a day. So you're taking 6 pills instead of 4.
You know that oil which that guy in Kolkata makes, you know, the special oil, what do you call it? When you have cuts and...
Oh, the jivan.
Yeah. That's kind of like basic stuff which works. Mm. But somebody actually taking a pulse diagnose and giving the right medicine and having it work, it just never happens.
Whereas
homeopathy is quite still, you know, if you look at Gaur Baba or people like that, they're pretty inspired. Mm. I mean,
they're just good. But even amongst homeopath people, he's still rare.
Yeah.
He's there, I think there's 1 or 2 guys in Calcutta.
Yeah.
One guy in Calcutta, he was a brahmachari.
Yeah.
So that was his thing. So, but
they have some shakti.
Yeah, they have some shakti. That's the main thing, is that they have some shakti.
For me, allopathy means it's like, okay, you've broken your leg, cut it open, stick it together, and close it up. The lawn parties you mentioned, but... Isn't like the festival they had with the chipped rice that they bought stuff from all over the place and everybody brought something there?
Yeah, but it was all put together into the same preparation that everybody got. So, in other words, if there's 100 people, everybody brought some raw ingredients that they put together into enough food for 100
people.
They have
to actually cook it at the same place, or
not
like householders,
that.
Like a Sunday feast. Isn't it also everybody just cooks one preparation?
But it should be enough for everybody. Let's say 30 people come for the lawn party.
Yeah.
So if you cook a preparation, cook for 30 people.
Yes, yes.
But most people cook for 5 or 6.
Yeah.
So a few people get something, or everybody gets this much. So it's more of just interaction. It's not the food.
Yeah. No, yesterday we had the Dasa Puja celebration, and actually every person who did a preparation did enough for 100 people.
That's fine.
And then you have 15 items.
Yeah, but that's fine. That's just everybody works
like
together.
That.
Yeah. But a lawn party, just everybody brings and hangs out, so it's the hanging out that's important.
No.
And there's something to eat, and so if someone who really wants to eat, then they're useless.
Yeah, it's not happening.
Yeah. Because you got something, there's nothing more of it, you can't, you know, like this and that. And
it's already gone.
Yeah, and someone else who didn't like it, didn't, you know, then wasted it. The point is that cooking, serving, eating, that whole, so that's just a way to organize it, you know. Like that view that everybody gives money, you cook it, everybody gives ingredients, you cook it, everybody cooks it themselves and brings it, but it's the idea is that you know, 30 people are eating, you're cooking for 30. I mean, 30 people eat, not 30 sparrows.
Yeah, thank you.
So I threw in your yogurt.
I noticed.
I throw it in quite regularly. It's at least really two or three times a year.
It's a really good phrase.
Yeah, it's just so typical.